Good morning, everyone. Wow, thank you so much for coming this morning. What a wonderful crowd. We have a very full agenda, so we're going to get started right away. First, we are going to present the annual Thursday Morning Roundtable Meritorious Service Award. The award began in 1972, established for commendable service to the community. TMR members nominate individuals who have made valuable contributions in the community without widespread recognition. Only volunteer efforts and accomplishments are considered. So TMR member Fred Fisk has agreed to present the award to this year's recipient. Fred?
Good morning, all. This year's honoree is a passionate advocate for a more compassionate world. This person has worked for decades as a pioneer in this person's field, an explorer, and a foot soldier. I'm talking about a resourceful innovator and a steady leader, building an inclusive community and improving the quality of life, particularly for people in need. This person doesn't toot a horn or rant and rave or massage an oversized ego. Instead, you find dogged determination, selfless service, and a wry twinkle. To this person, it is the cause that matters. I'm going to say more about this person, but I'm afraid I'll give the game away. So first, I'll tell you the name. Please give a warm initial round of applause to this year's honoree, our own Peter Sarver. Stay there, Peter, stay there. Now, Peter, while you're collecting your thoughts and preparing some very brief remarks, I'll continue. By the way, when I asked Peter's wife, Peggy, how he got to be so darn cute, she replied without hesitation, he got so cute and lovable from his mom, a wonderful woman and huge influence on his life. More than three decades ago, this mama's boy founded Hospice of Central New York to help the terminally ill live well right up to the end, at home if possible. Hospice and Peter's new idea at the time was to ease pain and discomfort, support families, and teach loved ones the common sense skills they need for end-of-life care. Hospice of Central New York grew and thrived during Peter's many years as CEO, and continues to do so to this day. Eager to expand the benefits of hospice where they're most needed, Peter was a founder of the Foundation for Hospices in Sub-Saharan Africa in 1999, amid the AIDS epidemic and other health crises. He nurtured a partnership with Island Hospice in Harare, Zimbabwe, and has led more than a dozen groups of hospice experts and others to the Sub-Sahara and hosted delegations visiting from Africa. But that's not all. Peter has been a quietly dynamic civic leader and social activist here in Central New York. His housing coalition for people with HIV/AIDS grew into Welch Terrace, supported housing. He served on the board, then he took over as manager, then he retired, and then he went back on the board. Recently, Peter has been a relentless advocate for inclusive transit solutions in Central New York, including bicycles. As convener of the Moving People Transportation Coalition, he's broadened discussion of I-81 alternatives through public meetings and focused on social justice, best practices, and outcomes. I could go on, but I'll talk fast and just mention Peter's current roles as interim co-executive of ACTS, a coalition of churches and groups working for change in Syracuse, chair of Ethics Healthcare of Central New York, which consults and educates local agencies and groups, and as a lay leader at his Lutheran church and for the last 17 years at St. Lucie's. There's more, but my time is up. I'm proud to invite to the podium this year's recipient of TMR's Meritorious Service Award, my friend and former neighbor, Peter Sarver.
I'll say just a few words. Wow is one. I'm really quite blown away by this honor, and I appreciate whoever put my name forward and so forth. But as I was reflecting on the group as I came in this morning, I wanted to remember my mentor, and some of you who are members of this group for a long time, Leo Javov, was the person who really helped launch Hospice of Central New York. And I know Leo was here for decades, probably, during the whole TMR experience. And he used to enjoy asking the first question, so I've tried to follow in that tradition and keep questions coming. But thank you very much. I appreciate this, and have a good morning.
What a great way to start the morning. Okay, so today we have with us two speakers who will be discussing, obviously, a very relevant and very timely topic. I want to thank Marilyn Pinsky, who has arranged for them to be here this morning, and Marilyn will introduce them.
Congratulations, Peter. I can't think of anyone more deserving. Thank you to Eileen Jevis for allowing me to co-sponsor this lecture in Philip's name for the second year, and for all her wonderful arrangements today. And to Sandra Barrett for year one, and a thank you to Linda Alexander for her overall support in getting the series started, and to Barry Schulman, who served on the committee that got us going. And I'm just amazed looking around at my friends, because except for Linda Land, I don't think any of us are really up at the crack of dawn. So. Our oldest daughter lives out of town, and our son is in Indianapolis presenting at a conference. So holding up the family end are our daughter and son-in-law, Lauren and Mark Craig. You have to stand a little bit. Philip spent a large part of his career working in the legislative process as the first assistant counsel to the majority leader of the New York State Senate, and then as a lobbyist for various clients, including those in the healthcare field. Being that he represented hospitals and medical groups who have to be concerned about anything affecting their bottom line to remain viable, and given that DSRIP that we'll hear about today has made some dramatic changes in the hospital landscape, I'm really not sure where Philip would be on this issue, but I hope he'd like hearing the outcomes that Jason will speak about. Then again, as the kids and I often think we're getting signs from Philip, if your table starts shaking, just ignore it. It is not directed at you. While the healthcare debate rages on in Washington, New York State is in year three of a five-year, $8 billion overhaul to its own Medicaid health insurance program for the low-income and disabled. But few people who are outside of the system really know about it. At an individual community level, you might read about a new program coming online, but how and why this is happening is all tied to a much larger picture of systems change. As a state Medicaid director, Jason Helgerson is the one controlling that change. Highly recruited to come to New York State to run the Medicaid redesign team, he was referred to by the New York Times as, quote, the Medicaid cost cutter from Wisconsin, though they added in another paragraph that everyone involved felt they got a fair shake. If there's a clue to who Jason really is, it might be in his Twitter handle, which is PolicyWonk1. Just to give you a sense of his uniqueness, the average tenure of a state Medicaid director in the whole country is about 2 years. Jason has been the director in New York State since January of 2011. I've had opportunities to see him in action, and he is cool and calm in very difficult situations, and I cannot imagine anyone else who who could survive under the stress of that job. I also love that Jason is asked to go to England to help them with their system. Virginia Opipari, Ginny, who will give the local perspective, is the director of the Central New York Care Collaborative, one of 25 performing provider systems in the state, and works closely with approximately 200 healthcare and community-based providers across six counties, Cayuga, Madison, Lewis, Oneida, Onondaga, Oswego. Prior to her role at the collaborative, Ginny worked with companies focused on strategic and technology consulting services, a biotech company, and many other healthcare initiatives throughout the country. Jason?
Well, good morning. It's certainly a pleasure to be here. I think this is my second time at the roundtable, although I think the last time I was here was either 2011 or 2012, so it's been a while. I actually am the longest tenured Medicaid director in the country. If you add up the last job I had, which was Medicaid director in Wisconsin, and the position here, over a decade in this job, which probably makes me not only the longest tenured, but probably the one most willing to take punishment for this job. So I'm going to try to just give you the broader context. Marilyn, I think, did a really nice job of saying there's a lot going on in Medicaid redesign. We've been at this now for over 6 years. Hundreds of projects have been implemented. Medicaid in New York is a very, very large and complex program. It's a $65 billion a year enterprise, and it serves about 6.2 million New Yorkers. It's the largest purchaser of healthcare services in the state. Every hospital in the state considers Medicaid an important revenue source and serves Medicaid members. The face of the Medicaid program has really changed, particularly since the Great Recession. I think many people sort of think about it as a program that serves low-income people, many of whom are not working. But actually, in reality, is that over 60% of people on Medicaid nationally are actually working every day. And you will see individuals every single day in your life and in your travels who rely on this program. It's a diverse program that serves everyone from 50% of all babies born in New York State are born while their mother is on the Medicaid program, to seniors and people with disabilities. About 70% of all the individuals in nursing homes today are on the Medicaid program. So it's a very diverse program that, as I say, millions of New Yorkers rely on every single day. So we take that into account when we make changes in the program, because it has real life, real people implications. And a program this size, this complex, you can't simply sort of turn it on a dime. It takes time to reform and change, and you have to do it in a thoughtful fashion. So today, I'll give a little bit of history of some of our earlier efforts, of how we got to where we are today. I'll focus most of my comments, which I'll try to keep brief, to what we're working on today, which is the delivery system efforts, DSHRP program, as we call it, as well as the move to value-based payment, which is to fundamentally change how we pay for healthcare. And I'll talk a bit about that. And then lastly, some things sort of to think into the future. And maybe a little bit of a challenge out to the community here around Syracuse about what all of you might want to think about in terms of next steps, in terms not only of healthcare, but how to improve the quality of life in communities such as this. So as I said, 6 million people. We have the second largest program in the country. When I started, we were the largest Medicaid program in the country. I was very happy to give that title to the state of California, who's a much larger state than us, by the way. They have about 10 million more residents than we do. And so the fact that we were larger in terms of Medicaid spending than they were, probably not a good thing. Things have changed, and I'll show you some slides. And as I say, it's $63 billion for the fiscal year that just ended, growing to $65 billion in the next year. That is all funds at state as well as federal and local dollars. So in 2010, when Governor Cuomo took office, and sometimes this feels like yesterday, sometimes this feels like 1,000 years ago, the Medicaid program was really in a state of crisis. Expenditures, the governor, when he took office, we were still in the midst of that horrific recession, which really fundamentally, this was actually the worst part point from a budgetary cycle standpoint. He was looking at greater than a $10 billion deficit. Medicaid was expected to grow at 13% year on year, and it's really, depending on how you measure it, either the biggest or the second largest chunk of the state budget. At the same time, while we were spending a lot of money, we were spending twice the national average on a per recipient basis. We weren't seeing the kind of results, not only for the Medicaid program, but for the healthcare system as a whole that we would expect. And in fact, the statistic that I think was most telling, and this is not just a metric for Medicaid, but for the system as a whole, and here in New York, we ranked dead last in the country in what's called avoidable hospital use. And I think avoidable hospital use is one of the most important measures in healthcare, and the reason is that it is a measure of overall system efficiency. Avoidable hospital use is when someone goes into an emergency room or someone goes into a hospital and they shouldn't be there. Because what they had, the condition they had, the reason that what drove them into that setting was something that, in fact, was preventable. It's a measure that shows that, in essence, we're not getting people the right care in the right setting at the right time. And we were ranked dead last. I mean, this is worse than Mississippi, worse than any of these other statistics, and despite the fact that we were spending so much money. And that to us was a sign that we actually had an opportunity to not only lower costs, because this is really wasteful expenditures, but also to improve the quality of life for thousands, and in fact, I would argue, eventually millions of New Yorkers. So the governor decided to create a task force, a team called the Medicaid Redesign Team, and task them with a very significant challenge of designing a pathway forward for this program. And that team accomplished its goal. And this is the plan that we basically already basically implemented over the last five plus years. As I said, it's hundreds of different individual projects that have gone into it. I was just speaking to someone before this, talking about one of our supportive housing projects, which has helped relocate particularly frail elders out of nursing homes and out of hospitals and other more expensive settings and getting them into apartments and all the work that they've done. I think they've successfully relocated 165 people right here in the greater Syracuse area. It's a great success story. That's like one of, as I said, hundreds of examples of things that are happening all across the state to fundamentally transform the experience, the healthcare, and broader set of services that individuals are getting. But the other thing about that's, I think, unique about this is that rarely does government stick to a plan for an extended period of time. Government typically will start down one path and then shift into a different direction. We basically stuck to the same plan for now what is really entering our seventh year. And what that has meant, I think, and this sort of relates a little bit to the discussion in Washington, is that it has helped, I think, all of the different actors in this complex system called healthcare, which is a sixth of our economy, mind you, to actually have a sense and some confidence that as they begin to change their business models, as they begin to change how they operate, they begin to change their relationships and the types of skills and staff and individuals that they hire to provide services, that they have some confidence that that they're changing in appropriate ways. And that kind of consistency, I think, is fairly rare. And I would argue one of our greatest accomplishments in Medicaid redesign is that we have stuck to our guns. We have stuck to our path. And I think that's helped us not only build momentum, but has gotten us as far as we have. And hopefully, and I'm happy to talk about Washington, but hopefully even outside of that, we can continue to move forward here in New York. So I think of Medicaid redesign sort of as three big steps. The first step, which we did mostly in the first year and a half to 2 years, was cost containment. We were inefficient. We were spending too much money on a per-person basis. We had policies and programs that were leading to that inefficiency. We made some pretty significant structural changes in the program, and as a result, we've generated some significant savings, and I'll show you that. But out of that, we also generate savings for the federal government. The way Medicaid works is the states put up money, and then those dollars are matched by the federal government. So when we reduce our per recipient spending, that generates not only savings for our taxpayers, but it also generates savings for Washington. Governor Cuomo, very successful, went back to Washington and said, hey, we have some structural problems in our delivery system. We need to make some targeted investments. We want to keep some of that savings in New York. And what came out of that was our DSHRIP program, which is this $8 billion investment, most of it going directly into the DSHRIP program to really transform the healthcare system. And that's a big part of what we're doing today. And then lastly is the move to what we call value-based payment. This is to begin to change the fundamental economics of healthcare in New York State. And it's actually a trend that's happening now across the country. Part of the reason why, and I'll show a chart in a minute, but we have a very expensive healthcare system in the United States, yet we do not generate outcomes close to what we should expect with that level of investment, especially when you compare it to the rest of the developed world. And part of the reason for that is how we pay for healthcare. We pay for units of service provided, whether those services provide quality, whether they are what's needed by the community, but we keep paying for more and more units. We create an incentive to provide ever higher levels of care, with very little incentive, very little money actually tied to outcomes. Did patients get better? Did the health of the community improve? And that's fundamentally what we're trying to change with regards to value-based payment. So the key components of Medicaid redesign is, first is we have a global spending cap. We have a limit that's tied to the medical portion of the consumer price index that grows over time. It has created tremendous transparency in the program. We publish a monthly report, but we track this program much more closely than we've ever done before. We used to have a system where about 13 individuals could make individual decisions and drive Medicaid expenditures. We now have a chief financial officer for the program. If he doesn't sign off on whatever change it is, regardless of how small it is, you can't spend dollars within the program. So that kind of consolidation and transparency, I think, has been good for the program. Next was care management for all. This is moving everyone into managed care. Some big changes. It brings greater accountability, brings greater ability to control costs in the program, and it's achieved those objectives, and most of those moves are complete. We also invested in high-quality primary care called patient-centered medical homes. We now have millions of New York Medicaid members who benefit from high-quality primary care. And we also launched what are called health homes, which is a very intensive care coordination program for individuals, particularly those with significant behavioral health needs. Those are the individuals who are in your emergency rooms 30, 40, 50 times in a year. They're also the individuals who not only touch and I'll talk about this a little bit later, not only touch the hospital or the healthcare system, but they also touch criminal justice or other types of issues. Those individuals need a lot of help to get and to navigate services, and we made that investment even during those difficult budgetary times. And then lastly, the social determinants of health. We spend $100 million a year now. This is money that we generated savings out of the program through our other efforts. We now spend $100 million on housing. And the reason we do that is because we have high-needs Medicaid members who, without housing support, without helping them find housing that's appropriate for their needs, will end up in nursing homes and hospitals, which is a more expensive form of, quote, housing. And that's one of the things we are doing, but we're constantly looking for new ways to address things called the social determinants of health. So here's our spending on a per-recipient basis. We now spend actually less on a per-recipient basis in New York Medicaid than we did in the year 2000. Now, if you look nationally, if you look at consumer or the private sector health plans, you will not see a downward trend like this. You will see an upward trend. In fact, that's been the trend in American healthcare for a very long time, is ever-increasing premiums that individuals pay. But throughout a period of growth in the program, we lived within the confines of the global spending cap. We now serve more people in the Medicaid program than ever before. As I say, north of 6 million. When I started, we were at about 4.2, 4.3 million people on the program. Now, part of that is the Affordable Care Act, but part of it also is the change in the structure of the economy in the state of New York, particularly upstate New York. When we came out of that Great Recession, we lost a lot of jobs that provided access to employer-sponsored insurance. The jobs that were created at post that recession are different, and fewer of them are offering that kind of employment services. That's why that the face of the Medicaid program has changed. And it's a little bit older population. It is a population that is more of the whom are working or are struggling to find work. And it's a very different population today than it was even in the, you know, sort of the 2008, 2009 timeframe. We, in addition to us bringing down, you see nationally that Medicaid spending went down. And while we don't yet have our rank, we used to rank fourth in the country on a per recipient basis. They haven't released those. What we do know is in New York, we reduced our per recipient spending by twice the amount that the nation as a whole. So we are narrowing the gap. We still do spend more on a per recipient basis. So there's still more potentially to do. Although I don't necessarily know we should aspire to spend as little on a per recipient basis as the state of Mississippi. That said, it was important for us to demonstrate not only to ourselves and to taxpayers that we could actually live within our means and actually function in a cost-effective fashion. It was important for us to demonstrate that to the federal government, because if we could demonstrate to them and convince them that our efforts are generating savings, that perhaps we could make the argument that we could get what's called a waiver, which is a federal, in essence, contract that allows us to potentially reinvest a portion of the savings. Our efforts, to give you a sense, over a five-year period, our initial set of cost containment efforts, the policies, procedures were developed during the and implemented during the first 2 years of this initiative, generated about $16 billion in savings. Half of that, that's for the federal government, I should say, $17 billion. About half of that, the federal government said, okay, we're going to let you keep those dollars over a five-year period and reinvest those back into the program. Most of those funds went into what's called the Delivery System Reform Incentive Payment Program, which at its core is designed not only to improve the efficiency of the Medicaid program, but actually fundamentally change how healthcare is provided to the broader population. That's why I think it's important to talk about, and I'll talk a bit about that now. So DSHRIP, what the heck is that? First off, worst acronym in the history of government, in my view, but it's not mine. I take no credit for this. It's the federal government created it for the state of California, and then we adopted it. Although there's four states that do DSHRIP, or now actually a fifth state that just got approved, the state of Washington. The only two states that look alike are us and the state of Washington. The other states, Texas, Florida, New Jersey, and California, their programs look nothing like ours. But that said, our version of it really is, as I said, to transform delivery. It created 25 of these performing provider systems. Ginny will talk about the one that is right here, and which is doing some amazing things, mind you. And the example that I gave of the housing is just one of them. But really what it was to try to make the healthcare system more patient-centered, less provider-centered, more transparent, more collaborative. And I think that's the key theme. Is the challenge in healthcare is that we tend in this country to think about it purely as sort of a competitive business. But yet it's a very strange competitive business in the sense that half the money for healthcare in the United States comes from the government. And the biggest actors, especially in this community, are not-for-profit, or in the case of Syracuse, one of the largest hospital systems, is a public entity. And for those not-for-profit, many of them religiously affiliated. Those are not your typical economic actors in most markets. And so as a result, we tend to think of them as competitors. But in reality, particularly for the Medicaid patients who need the most services, we need greater collaboration. We need fewer silos. We need organizations to work together, because a lot of these individuals bounce between these providers, generate tremendous costs, and have the quality of their lives decline. And then also accountability. As I said, in value-based payment, the reason is that there's very little money linked to outcomes, and we need to change that. We need it to be about paying for services that actually add value, improve health, not just more volume. And then lastly, value-driven. The healthcare system is not just a provider of care. As I said, in many cases, including I think in this community, it is also the largest or one of the largest employers. I believe at the end of the day, the healthcare system has a broader goal than just providing efficient service. They should begin to embrace the health of their community as part of their long-term objective and do things not just on their own, but in collaboration with other sectors, other organizations, to do more to improve health and well-being in their communities. So these 25 organizations, they're large, diverse. If they're smallest, they're hundreds. If they're largest, they're thousands of organizations that have come together in communities across the state. And you'll hear about the one right here in the Syracuse, Central New York region. But they're providers from across the entire spectrum. Their goal, their major objective, is to reduce that avoidable hospital use measure that I mentioned, where we rank dead last in the country. Their goal over the 5 years is to reduce that by 25%. over 10 years to cut that rate in half. So it's an ambitious program, significant amount of funding available to it. But, you know, as I say, and there's some, and you'll hear, I think, some very positive things that already come, even though we're only about halfway through the demonstration. So here's where we are. We're in the first quarter of the third year of the demonstration. The first couple of years were mostly focused on building infrastructure. They each performed provider system, picked specific projects. They had to stand up their organization. They had to get all these different partners to collaborate, which is not easy. Lots of that work has now been complete, and now really where we are is performance. The key thing about this program is if you don't perform, you don't get paid. And there are hundreds of millions of dollars running at risk based on performance. So these organizations have a lot of pressure being applied to them and to their key network partners. So there's a lot going on, but we really are now getting to that phase where it's not just about standing up programs and doing good things and getting everybody on board. Now that group, those organizations, those projects, they really have to be performing. If they don't perform, they don't get paid. So in addition to delivery system reform, we also need to change the fundamental economics of healthcare. We want healthcare providers to succeed financially when they really do a good job of serving the needs of patients and the health of those individuals improves and the health of the community improves. Right now, the incentives are very perverse. A hospital is better off financially if the individuals that they serve exit their hospital and then within 30 days get readmitted. Why is that good for them? Well, that's another head in the bed, as it's sometimes used within the field. And if you don't have heads in the beds, that's less revenue to you as an organization. And what I say is that as long as that is the major financial incentive in American healthcare, we are going to have bad outcomes for a whole lot of money. We have to fundamentally change that. We want healthcare providers to actually have the incentive to actually keep people in the community, in their homes, in their healthy as is humanly possible for as long as possible. That should be the fundamental goal. And when they're successful in that, they're better off financially. To give you one flavor of what we're trying to do is this is now move to a value-based payment system, a system that rewards that kind of behavior. One simple example of what this means. There's a hospital system in the Bronx called Montefiore. It's a very large system. It's been in what's called value-based payment for an extended period of time. One of the things they found in this environment was they looked at the various patients who were in their emergency room a lot. And one population they looked at were patients with COPD, so chronic lung disease. Many of these are seniors, people who don't have as much family support. And what they also, when they really looked into it, they saw spikes in the emergency room utilization during the summer months. And when they looked a little bit deeper, they found those spikes were occurring at a time when the temperature was rising above 80 degrees. And then they said, well, maybe we should ask these people, talk to them. Why are they in the emergency room? And they found out that the major driver was that most of these individuals did not have air conditioning. So they have chronic lung disease. Temperature is rising. They are locked into these apartments, right? Many of them are less than ideal places to live anyways, and they don't have family support. There's no cooling stations for them to go to or ones that they can get to very easily. And so what they found was that, or when they thought about this and they talked to the actually affected individuals, they decided that a $250 room air conditioner was a cheaper, more effective strategy than constantly cycling them through the emergency room. And what they did was when they implemented this relatively low cost project, right, with them, some of the Medicaid, by the way, doesn't pay for air conditioners traditionally, right? There's no code you can bill for an air conditioner. That they use their flexibility through value-based payment and the incentives it creates to actually invest in these air conditioners, bring down their overall spending, and as a result of meeting these incentives, they actually were able to capture the savings. People were better off, they were happier, healthier, and the organization was better off financially. Remember, this is a hospital, so that meant there was less ER utilization. But yet, because of the change in the payment system, they were able to capture the savings, and that's really what value-based payment's all about. So as I say, the challenge in American healthcare today is that we're on the left side of this chart, which means that if I do something, if I'm a hospital, I invest in discharge planning, one of the most important things a hospital does, which is to try to help. I just had a procedure. I need to know, what do I need to do to stay healthy, to recover from this, right? We also know from the research that 80% of what patients hear at the point of discharge, they don't remember. Why? Because they just had a procedure done. Right? They're coming out, they had anesthesia, it was a shocking, it was painful, they are uncomfortable, all they want is out of the hospital as quickly as they can, and so information, that is not a very good environment to basically absorb very complex information. Plus, most patients are not physicians or nurses and such, so we're not naturally, you know, inclined to be able to successfully get that information. But at the same time, if an organization like a hospital invests in evidence-based procedures to improve that information flow, really help to connect individuals to other types of providers to ensure a smoother transition and less readmissions, what happens? That's less revenue for that organization. And it creates a significant disincentive for providers to make those kinds of good investments. So what we need to do is get to the right side where when I do something that increases value to the community, to the patient, I'm actually better off financially, and that's what value-based payment's about. So we have a very ambitious agenda. The federal government is obligating us to move 80% of that $60-plus billion into a value-based payment system. So as we move in this direction, and Medicare is also moving in this direction, you add up Medicare and Medicaid, we're 50% of all the spending in the state of New York for healthcare. So as we move in this direction, it's going to move the rest of the market. So all New Yorkers are going to begin to see, I think, hopefully, the benefits of the move away from fee-for-service to value, which I think ultimately will lead to a system that's more patient-centered, that's more collaborative, more coordinated. And ultimately, I think we're going to begin to see different types of services, maybe not everybody getting air conditioners, but different types of services being offered to individuals that are better in line with the needs of the community. That certainly is our expectation. Where we are is we have to get to that 80% goal by the end of the decade. Right now, we just did a survey looking at 2016, and we're about a third of the way there. About 35%, 34% of our current expenditures are value-based. So we're not starting in ground zero. So there's people like Montefiore who are out there, but there is more work to be done. In fact, there's some pilots that are being launched as we speak, including a pilot right here in the Syracuse region. So I'll end on this before is just a sense of the future state. And this is part of my challenge. And as I get an opportunity post New York State budget process, is I get a chance to travel around New York and a chance to talk to folks. And one of the challenges I like to bring to communities, and I think this group is uniquely positioned, is to think beyond, in our case, the healthcare system, think beyond healthcare, but it's a challenge out to other sectors as well, is to think about from a community-wide perspective, what are the biggest challenges facing your community? What are probably the best metrics for understanding what those challenges are? And what can a community do collectively to address those? And I think some of our most intractable community challenges are intractable because they are not the sole responsibility of one sector. No one ultimately in some of these cases is actually accountable for that particular metric today. And in healthcare, sometimes we use the word social determinants of health, which I sometimes say is actually a selfish term, because what we're saying to the rest of the community is, hey, guys, come help us lower healthcare costs. Come help us improve our healthcare metrics, right? Human service providers, join our effort, right? But rarely do we in healthcare turn around and say, you know what? What metrics do you care about, and what can we in the healthcare sector do to help you address those concerns? Because we're the big employers, right? We are in this community as well. We should care about those other societal metrics. And that's why, in our view, we need to start thinking beyond our healthcare metrics to start embracing things like kindergarten readiness. One of the most powerful predictors of lifetime success is a child entering the kindergarten, entering the public school system, developmentally where they should be. Shockingly, 40% of kids in the United States are not developmentally where they should be when they enter four-year-old or five-year-old kindergarten. They're developmentally behind. And it's consistently been that way for year after year after year after year. 40% failure rate. And yet, almost nothing. Where's the public, national public outcry around that? And part of the reason is it's a series of systems who don't talk to each other, and we just consistently fail over and over again. But communities are the ones who need to address it. The healthcare system has to be part of that effort. Community happiness. We know in the healthcare system that when people are depressed, when they are unhappy, when they don't no longer feel that their options if their options are closing in on them, that the chances of success in their for their children is diminished, that all of that contributes to higher healthcare costs. All of that contributes to shortened life expectancy. But yet, almost no one measures community happiness, quality of life. We use the words quality of life all the time, but how do we measure it? There are metrics out there for quality of life, but who actually utilizes them? Very few people. But I think at some point, communities have to start thinking about how they start thinking about and measuring those things. And then lastly, mortality. Sometimes in healthcare, we're resistant to embrace this measure. We do in certain areas, but not generally. But it's also a metric that's not unique to healthcare, right? The criminal justice system cares about mortality, right? So should every other system. We should all collectively be looking, because obviously we want to lower the mortality rate, avoidable mortality rate, to the maximum degree we can. So when I think about DSHRP and I think about the move value-based payment, I think about the future state. Really what we want to do is, within healthcare, and I would say the challenge is out to the other sectors and people who purchase services from other sectors as well, is we really need to start putting the person and the family in the center and getting better collaboration and coordination across these complex systems. And this is where I say is that we're trying to break down the silos within the healthcare system. We're trying to get primary care physicians to work with hospitals and nursing homes. Man, what is a PPS? That's exactly what it is. It's an effort to get all the healthcare providers in a community to mobilize around better outcomes for the vulnerable in their community. But that's just healthcare. What we also need is all these other sectors, right? Because the low-income families, the families who are most challenged, who we see in our emergency rooms when they shouldn't be there, are also challenged and receiving services from social services, education. Unfortunately, far too often, they're bumping into them and utilizing services in the criminal justice system. They have housing and employment issues. But the problem is that a lot of times these systems, they don't talk to each other. They don't work together. In fact, we sometimes work at cross purposes from each other. And I say the ultimate, and for folks who are concerned about Washington and how do we respond to Washington and some of the agenda coming from Washington, is I think a lot of this is you don't solve this in Washington. You also don't solve this in Albany. You solve this in local communities across the state when you actually get individuals who live in those communities to sit around a table and say, you know what? There are processes. There's things that we can do to improve outcomes that we can, if we just work together. Yes, we always could ask for more money, but there are things that we could do collectively better than we do today. And I think that's the challenge. I'll give you one example of a project we are joined in Albany County. It's around school readiness, right? Once again, a school district in Albany, 82% of those children of color, and north of 40% of those kids are in school developmentally behind. We have the early intervention program. We have 4-year-old kindergarten for everyone. We have 3-year-old kindergarten slots and other programs. We have lots and lots of programs. But yet, year after year, kids are entering those programs developmentally behind where they should be. We also know that 99% of kids see a pediatrician because of the Medicaid program in their first year of life. Pediatricians are providing services. We pay the pediatrician to do developmental screens. The pediatricians are open to use whatever developmental screen they want, and they are not required to send that information and data to anyone, to us or health plans or whoever. But yet, when children finally get into the public school system has no idea what their developmental needs are and have no idea until they assess them themselves. That is the first point in which we have population-wide assessment of the needs of those children. And what we find is that their needs are greater and are not necessarily what the school district predicted they would be. And so we end up with a rookie teacher in a classroom that has 40% of kids with developmental issues and a veteran teacher in a classroom that has less than 10% of the kids with developmental things. Completely reverse of what you normally would do. It's because the school district is flying blind. So what we're trying to do is say, okay, so we, the healthcare system, are touching these kids. We're touching virtually all of them. But we're just not doing a good enough job of identifying them and getting them into care. And so what we're now doing is using value-based payment to pay pediatricians differently to get them to be a part of a broader system, to identify more kids who have developmental needs, refer them for treatment, to begin to actually track each year of life. There's about 1,000 kids in each of these years in Albany. How are they doing developmentally? Are we improving them? Are we? What are their developmental needs? Do we have the right set of services? All of that, but it has to be done at a local level. Can't be done at a statewide level. We just happened to join this effort because it was brought to us as an opportunity. But I think there's lots of other opportunities that communities can do all across the state to really improve outcomes for people in your community. So that's the Rubicon we're trying to cross in the future. I think there's great opportunities here. But with that, I'll turn it over to Ginny to talk about some of the exciting things happening right here in Syracuse.
Thanks, Jason. First of all, I want to thank Marilyn for inviting me to be here with you this morning. And I want to congratulate the honoree, Peter. Your organization is a partner organization of the Central New York Care Collaborative, and we thank you for all those efforts. And I certainly want to thank Jason for his invaluable leadership as we move forward with this important transformational work. So the Central New York Care Collaborative is the lead performing provider organization in this region. And up here you can see that we cover the 6 counties that you heard Marilyn mention. We have over 2,000 healthcare and community-based providers that are in our organization, and we have the responsibility for over 200,000 Medicaid lives. So this is a very important initiative for Central New York, and we're working very hard and passionate about this transformational effort. So the focus of the Central New York Care Collaborative is on these areas, and you heard Jason touch on many of them, but first and foremost, what we're working to do is create this transformational effort. We have many partner organizations that are part of our network. And as you know, some of those organizations are in competition with one another. And what we're working to do in this transformational effort is to build real collaboration across the region. And we are having success in doing that, I'm pleased to tell you. So we are working to get the movement towards the value-based payment, the movement towards outcomes, and not just focused on having the patient come back for repeated visits. As you heard Jason say, the current incentives from the reimbursement system pay every time you visit. So the idea is the more visits, the more money that goes into the system. But that doesn't necessarily do anything to improve your quality. So we are working hard to provide education, deep education, to get movement towards working towards the outcomes and to achieve this value-based payment methodology. We have to provide some tools and some infrastructure in order to help the region achieve this, because it just doesn't come naturally. This transformational change is not something that comes easy for anyone. So we are building tools, including a population health management system. So we're working with IBM Watson to provide a data infrastructure across our whole region that will integrate all of the medical records that are out there through the electronic medical record system. So we will be integrating across our region 44 electronic medical records and focusing on care coordination for the high-risk patient population, for the vulnerable patient population. We are including in that the social and behavioral determinants of health. Because as you heard Jason mention, what we've all learned from this initiative is frequently it is that situation that the patient doesn't have air conditioning. We have as a partner organization Meals on Wheels, for example. And, you know, when I met with the leader for the local Meals on Wheels initiative here in Onondaga County, what he told me was a startling statistic. And that is, for the Meals on Wheels population, and they serve all ages, and they have both, you know, Medicare and dual-eligible Medicaid patients, 60% of the patients that are 65 and older are malnourished. And, you know, that was an astounding statistic to me. So not only does it happen at the early age groups, like Jason was indicating, but it happens at the other end of the spectrum as well. And fundamental nutrition is a very basic need for health. So these are the kinds of things that we're looking at. Obviously, we will be focusing on reducing the cost and creating a situation where we can avoid those unnecessary ED visits and the avoidable readmissions. This is our organization. It was formed for this sole purpose. We are an independent company. We have four members that started our organization. They're the large hospital systems in the region, St. Joe's, Upstate, Faxon, St. Luke's, and Auburn Community Hospital as well. We have a 22-member board. One of our board members is in the audience. That's Liz Nolan, who is in the back of the room. Liz is a member of our board. She also leads one of our important board committees on the workforce initiative. So this is our organizational structure. It's a very active structure that involves all of the community leaders. So this is a group of our partners. We have all 11 hospitals in the region that are considered partner organizations. We have 5 federally qualified health centers. We have 80 mental health and substance abuse providers, 3 health home and 20 care management agencies. We have skilled nursing and hospice and palliative care facilities. So we cover the entire gambit of the healthcare environment and landscape here. We also have many community benefit organizations like Meals on Wheels, Salvation Army, many organizations that are really critical and provide essential services beyond what we traditionally think of in healthcare, which is the traditional sort of hospital and physician. But what these community benefit organizations are providing are really critical and important services, and we're making very important connections for them. As Jason said, this all started in the first few years of the district program began with building the infrastructure and starting on some of these projects that, based on the state's knowledge, demonstrated that if you do some of these projects and establish some of this infrastructure, that will move you towards the right direction. So the early years of our company were focused on first building the company because it was a new startup, but also establishing these 11 projects that were selected across our region. They fall into 3 domains. The first domain was the system transformation, and there are a group of projects falling in that group. The clinical improvement domain, which focuses a lot on behavioral health and substance abuse across the region, and then some population health that also deals with reducing premature births. So just some snippets of some things that have been happening. So here's a situation where the Salvation Army participates in one of our projects. And what we do is we try to reach out to patients who are underutilizers of care. Because if you're not in the healthcare system, it's hard to be helpful. So the Salvation Army has a variety of people that walk in their doors, and they walk in sometimes for the food pantry. So as a result of that, we were able to connect someone who didn't have healthcare. And as a result of this screening tool that was applied through one of our projects, the patient got connected to healthcare, and these are kinds of quotes that the patient said. She really didn't know what was missing in managing her disease. So just making these connections for the patients makes all the difference in the world. So we are connecting patients through this PAM screening tool that have not had the ability to be followed in the healthcare system. At Upstate University, one of the programs that they've implemented is a care transitions program. So, you know, what happens, you get great care when you're in hospitals, when you're in an acute care setting, but things start to fall apart once you leave that setting. And as Jason said, oftentimes patients don't know what to do after their discharge, or they can't remember. So what Upstate University has done, the hospital, they have put in a very elaborate care transitions model that makes those connections for the patients, follows up with the patients to make sure that they're keeping the appointment and that they're getting the right setting of care in the right time. So part of this transformation is making sure that we get the patient situated at the right time, when they need it the most, in the right setting of care. And a lot of times people don't know where to go to get the care, and so they go to an emergency department. That's one reason why the cost of the emergency department and why we have oftentimes unnecessary visits in the ED, because patients don't know where to go. So making these connections has been very important. We also have several areas where we have integrated behavioral health and primary care. Again, making the connections. You heard Jason talk about that. That's so important. And building these connections between what were in the past more fragmented providers. So we're integrating primary care and behavioral health, and we have several examples of that that weren't here before, but as a result of this program are now across the region. So that you don't have to go two places. If you're there seeing a primary care physician and there's someone that has depression, going back to that message of do we have a happy community, depression is a very, very common symptom that people present with, and oftentimes it can be treated. But if left untreated, it goes on to some very serious problems. So integrating, and when a patient presents, and providing the right kind of screening tools for early identification and then matching up with the right type of care setting is some of the major accomplishments, I think, that we've achieved thus far. So to date, and these are just some of them, there are many, we have engaged over 700,000 patients since we started this, which is a really critical and an astronomical number. So we have touched that many patients' lives since we started this initiative. We have developed structures and venues. So the main thing, a lot of the healthcare providers were separate and didn't speak with one another. We have connected them together, and we create forums for that discussion. We have created standards of care to provide evidence-based medicine across the region. We have achieved, I'm not going to touch on every one of them because you can read this, but we have mobile crisis teams that have been developed across the region for behavioral health care so that if something happens, there's a team that can respond immediately to your needs. We have achieved this PCMH Level 3 recognition, which is a whole care coordination function for the high-risk Medicaid patients. And we have several of these care coordination venues that have been established that were not here before through health homes, and we're working very hard to support those and grow those to meet the patient's needs. And we have developed cultural competency and health literacy programs across the region. We have a robust workforce initiative that's looking in delivering this type of care. What is the workforce that we need to do that? So, you know, we are focused on the patient, but we're also focused on the enablers that have to be there to achieve the results. And then looking ahead, we are evolving into an integrated delivery network across this region. So we're building the connections with all of the healthcare partners, not just those that are the traditional partners that you're very familiar with, but also those community benefit organizations that provide those essential services right in the community, taking the services to the patient, focusing on a patient-centered approach to care, not one that's institutionalized, but taking things to the patient and looking at the patient's needs as the center of what we're working to achieve. We're identifying those high-risk patients, which is key to the success, because the vulnerable patient population that we serve, many of them have very high risks, and being able to identify those risks and knowing how to tackle each of those risks is very important. And so we're working hard to do that. We're developing a clinically integrated model of care. So this, you hear me use words like integration, collaboration. That's what this is all about, is building those connections to eliminate this fragmentation in our healthcare delivery system and to take the best that each of our healthcare providers can supply for the patient and link that for the sake of the patient. So we're going, and we're measuring. We will be measuring, as Jason said. We will be measured by Jason, but we're measuring because of that to make sure that we're going to achieve the outcomes. So I create dashboards where we track and trend how we're doing across our region to look at both our progress on connecting patients into our projects and also on achieving the desired outcomes. And we were providing tools and infrastructure. And the two main things that we need is we need data. We need a data system to be able to identify those patient needs and identify the high risk. And we need a care coordination module that will help us, once we identify those patients with high risk, to be able to communicate across our region, because the patients go to different providers. It's not as though they have one provider and they just go there. They can be seen across our network in any number of places. And today, if you walk into a given hospital, they have an EMR. They know what happens within their walls, but they don't know what happens outside of that. And the Healthy Connections has helped to give real-time alerts to the doctors of when a patient appears in various places. But the Healthy Connections does not provide the care coordination and a lot of the social and behavioral determinants of health that the population health management system that we're putting in place will. So we're very passionate about this. We're excited about what has been achieved. We look forward to the future, and I'm happy to be here this morning to be able to talk with you about it. I think we ran a little bit over time. I'm sorry about that.
To me, an excellent presentation. Thank you very much for coming and sharing with us. My question goes to this. A few years ago, we had leadership from the local hospitals come here and explain their reaction, if you will, to the Affordable Care Act as they were implementing it, how it transformed their hospitals, et cetera. Obviously, your transformational process has been very successful and productive so far. Currently, as we know, at the federal level, they're talking about repealing the Affordable Care Act that had a lot of these same principles embedded in it as you had in your process here. My question is twofold. If what you've done here has been so successful, is it something that can be applied to the Medicare program as opposed to just Medicaid? And two, what really would happen if truly Affordable Care Act went away? Would it not affect any of this at all, or could it have an impact?
Sure. So I'll take the second question first, which is, and it's the question I get asked more than any other question, because it's the top of mind a lot of people, is so the American Healthcare Act, which is in essence the replacement for Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, which is now looking as if it may actually have the votes to pass the House of Representatives maybe as early as next week. What does that mean for all this that's been done here in New York, our efforts to date? So the governing document for the district program that we're talking about is not impacted by the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. It is a separate agreement between the state and the federal government. That agreement was extended for 5 years at the end of the Obama administration. It is a two-way agreement. It's a contract, in essence, between the state and the federal government. Federal government cannot end that contract without agreement from the state of New York, and we're not going to agree to end this program. So as a result, and that was a top priority for us to get that approved. So we have confidence that this program will continue on regardless of what happens in Washington. That said, the American Healthcare Act would be devastating for New Yorkers. It would probably cost us billions of dollars of lost revenue and put us in a very difficult situation in terms of our ability to maintain coverage for all of the 6 million people that we are providing care to today. Now, the likely implications of that act will not really be felt until beginning in 2020. So we have a bit of lead time to sort of prepare for that. And the obvious implications are not just for the Medicaid program, but also for the thousands of people who receive tax credits and other things to buy health insurance. And so the implications, I don't want to say that they're not significant. They are significant, and that's why we've been advocating against the American Health Care Act. But that said, people ask, well, what should we do in this period of uncertainty? Because even if it passes the House, there's certainly no guarantee that that bill, in fact, that bill as it is today, unlikely to pass the Senate. So what does that mean for us? And I say that what is most likely coming out of Washington is that at some point, when that point is, we do not know. And to some degree, and we don't know what that degree is, we will end up with less federal money into our healthcare system in New York State. And so in the face of that, what do we do? And I say, my response is that if you think about what DSRIP and the value-based payments and all that's about, it's really about trying to achieve greater efficiency in our healthcare system. We're trying to get better results at a lower cost. So in response to less money coming from Washington, our response should be the same, right? We should want to do better for less. And if nothing, my key comment here is that if anything, what's happening in Washington is it should light a little bit more fire under us to move even faster, to leverage the dollars that are coming here through the DSRIP program to maximize the value so that if that day does come, and we should resist it, but if the day does come when there's less federal money in, we are better prepared for it than we are today. And those projects, those initiatives that you're seeing that are being done right here in central New York are the kinds of things that can help us better weather that storm if it does in fact come.
My question is it's a square peg in a round hole question. There's a considerable large group of people in this state who receive Medicaid services by accident of history, people with developmental disabilities. All the things you've talked about, they aren't patients. 90% of the services they receive have nothing to do with hospitals, doctors, nurses, or anything medical for that matter. Yet there's an overlay of accountability that looks just like the Medicaid system, quite frankly, which is burdensome and probably raises the administrative cost of running programs by agencies. Is anyone in your office looking at this anomaly and trying to figure out a way of, in a sense, carving out this group who don't really fit with the rest of healthcare services and Medicaid?
So I think the population you're probably mostly talking about are people with developmental disabilities. And there's about 120,000 individuals who are part of the developmental disability service delivery system, which in New York State is a unique system. They are, in essence, carved out in the sense that there's a system that's been built up around them. But I hear you loud and clear about of which Medicaid is the funder of the vast majority of those services. And it's not an inconsequential budget. It's somewhere in the range of about $6 billion is spent on those 120,000 individuals. And their needs are great, and their needs are mostly not medical. Although when you actually look into it at a little bit greater depth, they also utilize quite a lot of healthcare services in addition to residents, housing or work supports or other family supports that exist for the population. But I would actually argue that you wouldn't want to carve them out, so to speak, from the benefits of a more integrated, more person-centered healthcare system, because I think at the end of the day, to a great extent in New York, they have been cut out. They've been isolated. They have their whole own state agency. And part of the issue there is that you're right that regulations have grown up around those programs that have increased the cost to providers and that also have unintended consequences. One of the most common unintended consequences that I hear that providers of these services for this very vulnerable population say is that oftentimes they're obligated to call 911, bring in or have individuals go into emergency rooms for precautions. precautionary purposes, and that's not in the best interest of those individuals, and it adds to cost and other issues. I think that a lot of what we're trying to do here could actually benefit that population, and we're working hard to try to make sure that they are, in fact, part of this broader transformation effort. That said, there are some specific efforts going on in that system. Because at the end of the day, the measures, the outcomes, the goals that we're trying to achieve for that population are going to be a little bit different than they are for the rest of the population.
So please join me in thanking Jason and Ginny for joining us today.